beautifully on smartphones, tablets, and computers. It's a fast-paced world. People want your information now, on the go. Your web page needs to look professional and function quickly and easily on all devices. PowerShift designers work with you side by side and can teach you to manage your site without unnecessary expense and hassle. PowerShift and Stowe, pshift.com.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Thank you, Jim Connie. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. A little heavy fog out there this morning, a little dark out there, too. But forecaster Roger Hill says we're going to get a nice day, a couple of nice days to follow. Thanks for joining us this morning on the program. Coming up later this hour, we're going to chat with Chris Kerrigan. He's going to tell us about a conference that's coming up tomorrow, that a trade show on manufacturing in Vermont. So that'll be coming away at about 9:30 this morning. We'll take your phone calls throughout the program this morning. Always love to hear from you. 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. Our White House crew in hour number two will tell us what the latest is on the airstrikes in Syria. Boy, this just sounds like scary stuff. Also, we'll chat a little bit about the VPR debate last night, their gubernatorial debate, and I'll see if I can actually run you a couple of clips from it. It was, I have to say, I felt like I was watching a 17-car pileup, but maybe that was just me. We'll take your phone calls throughout the program at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. But really, what an honor. We have a really great guest joining us on the program this morning to talk about the adolescent brain, which has really gotten quite a bit of research. And Dr. Lawrence Steinberg is joining us. He has written a book called Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. And I'm not going to use up a lot of time talking about his credentials, but they're pretty awesome. One of the things that Dr. Steinberg was involved in, he was the lead scientist in the preparation of the American Psychological Association's amicus brief to the U.S. Supreme Court in a case which abolished the juvenile death penalty. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about some of his research on the adolescent brain. And let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Dr. Lawrence Steinberg. Thank you for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So, you know, first let's talk about this case that you worked on. This was a big deal. How did you get involved in the one that wound up abolishing the juvenile death penalty?
Well, the American Psychological Association, every once in a while decides it wants to weigh in on an important Supreme Court case. And they actually have a committee of the association that looks at these things and sees what's on the docket and whether psychologists should take a stance. So the association approached me and said, we want to help put together the psychological science and the brain science that might persuade the court to get rid of the juvenile death penalty, and would you head up a team of people to review the legal brief and just make sure that the science is accurate? So that's really the role that I played. We were the last civilized society in the world to get rid of the juvenile death penalty. It was really kind of appalling compared to the rest of the world that we were still sentencing people to die for things that they did when they were just kids. I mean, I can hardly get the words out. You know, it seems so odd to me.
What do you think the argument was that was compelling to the court?
I think that the argument that was compelling was sort of a two-pronged one. One is that we save the harshest punishments that we have, and death is obviously the harshest one, for people who are fully responsible for their behavior. Under American criminal law, we have to decide how responsible somebody is in deciding what a proper sentence is for a crime. So if you, if you commit a crime and somebody's pointing a gun to your head, we don't sentence you the way that we would if you did it voluntarily. Mm-hmm. So we put together evidence showing that adolescents they're not as able to control themselves, their impulses and their urges and thinking ahead and things like that, as adults are. And we shouldn't use the punishment that we save for the worst of the worst, in evaluating the behavior of kids. That was one part of the argument. The other was that, the brain is still maturing and still growing at that point, which makes kids better candidates for rehabilitation than adults. So we also used those arguments to get the Supreme Court to place limits on using life without the possibility of parole as a sentence for juveniles.
Right.
So that's been, it hasn't been eliminated, but it's going to be far less common because of the court's recent rulings.
Right. That was a Florida case that you worked on.
Exactly. And then there was an Alabama case that came up a couple years after the Florida case that actually ended up making it unlawful for states to have mandatory life without parole for certain crimes committed by juveniles. So that guarantees that even if a kid commits homicide, that a court has to look at the individual case before deciding to sentence him to life in prison. It can't be mandated by their legislature.
We're talking with Dr. Lawrence Steinberg. He's a professor of psychology at Temple University, the author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Why is there so much research going on in the adolescent brain?
Because we've discovered that it is a time when the brain changes an awful lot, and that really wasn't known until, maybe about 15 years ago. The brain reaches its adult size, the volume of the brain itself, by the time people are 11 or 12. And so until we had brain imaging technology widely available, I think it was assumed that the brain stopped really developing after people reached that age. But with the advent of fMRI and other brain imaging techniques, scientists began to look at how the brain functioned and found that there were lots of changes taking place inside the brain, even though it didn't look like those changes were taking place if you just looked at it, with the naked eye on the outside. So as it became clear that there was a lot of brain maturation going on during adolescence, more and more research started to be done, and it turns out that it really is an extraordinary time for brain development. Probably, the second most important after the first few years of life.
Mm-hmm. Why does this period of time involve so much risk-taking, so much impulse control, all that kind of stuff?
It's an interesting story. It has to do with the way in which the brain changes when kids go through puberty. So we think of sex hormones as doing things like, increasing our sex drive or changing our outward appearance, but they actually affect the way the brain develops. And one of the things that they do is intensify our experience of pleasure. And this really makes good things feel better during adolescence. In fact, I think a lot of adults will be unhappy to hear this, but they will never feel as good, as excited, as they did when they were teenagers because of the changes in the brain that take place. And when these changes take place during adolescence, it makes kids want to seek out exciting and pleasurable experiences, even if there are risks and dangers involved. The problem is that this is happening at a time when brain systems that regulate impulse control are still quite immature. So it is really like kind of starting the engines without a good braking system in place. And that is why there's so much risky and reckless behavior during adolescence.
Hmm. But, I mean, is there like an evolutionary reason? Why would we be built this way so that risk-taking happens at that period of your life and not, later on or earlier?
Yeah, good question. Well, all mammals go through puberty, and so we can learn something about human adolescence by looking at other species. And in all mammals, after the juvenile goes through puberty, he or she tends to kind of wander away from the family and go out in search of a mate. And that's very risky to do because the juvenile has to compete with bigger and stronger adults for these resources and opportunities, and has to learn how to manage, life for itself without the protection of the animals that have taken care of it. And we think that when humans evolved, this was the case for us as well. And so in order to guarantee that we would reproduce and go through this process of leaving parents and go out in the wild in search of a mate, we had to hardwire the brain so that we would be more willing to take risks at this time. So it looks like adolescence is a time when we are kind of almost programmed to be more tolerant of risk.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you write about is how adolescence is longer than it used to be when you and I were growing up, and you make the argument it's biological and cultural is sort of what my takeaway was. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah. Well, adolescence begins a lot earlier now because the age of puberty has been getting younger and younger. So the average American young person today goes through puberty, well, maybe 2 years earlier than was the case in the middle of the 20th century, not all that long ago from an evolutionary point of view. And this is because of obesity. You know, kids who are fatter go through puberty earlier than those who are thinner, and we know there's been an epidemic of childhood obesity. It's because of the exposure of our kids to chemicals in foods and cosmetics and plastics and pesticides that disrupt their hormones and make them mature earlier. And there's even some evidence, new evidence, that exposure to the kind of light that is emitted from computer monitors and tablets and smartphones may also be contributing to this earlier onset of puberty. So
wow.
That's one factor. The other factor is that it's taking people longer to finish up adolescence and to become adults in terms of entering the full-time labor force or cutting the financial umbilical cord from their parents or, you know, getting married. And so the average 25-year-old today is twice as likely to still be a student as was the case when we were growing up. So as a combination of those two things, the earlier onset of puberty and the delayed transition into adulthood, adolescence now is about a 15-year proposition, which is twice as long as it was in the 1950s.
Wow. You know, that's so interesting that the front end of it, you talk about puberty, which is more kind of a chemical thing, and then the back end of it, you're talking more of a social thing.
Yeah, although as I argue in the book, that social thing may be having effects on the brain that actually are good. Because one of the really exciting discoveries about the adolescent brain is that it's very malleable or plastic. That's the word that neuroscientists use to describe the brain when it's easily influenced by the environment. And it looks like that window of brain plasticity that coincides with adolescence might be able to be kept open a little bit longer by actually slowing the transition into adulthood rather than rushing it. That comes as a surprise to a lot of people, and I think it comes, you know, maybe as some kind of comfort to a lot of people in their 20s who haven't yet settled down and who are, I think, kind of rightly tired of being told, you know, to grow up and get on with it. Because I think that we do paint a very unflattering picture of people in their 20s today in the popular media that is undeserved.
Mm-hmm.
I really argue for rethinking the timetable that people are on during these years.
Let's go to Sheldon. Ruth, good morning.
Yes, I was wondering if there's a link between the adolescent brain and schizophrenia and the use of marijuana.
Okay.
Really good question. It's controversial. Let me begin by saying that adolescence is the time when most major mental illnesses have their first appearance. The average age across serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia or depression or bipolar disorder, the average age of onset is 14. And one of the reasons for that it has to do with something I was talking about a moment ago, which is that the adolescent brain is very sensitive to experience. It's usually affected by experience. The issue with schizophrenia and marijuana use is complicated. There is some evidence that chronic use of marijuana early during adolescence may increase the risk of developing certain kinds of mental illnesses, including schizophrenia. It appears to be the case that this may be only true for people that have a certain genetic profile. And I'm not an expert in that, and I couldn't begin to tell you what the genetic profile that places people at risk for this is. But I guess the bottom line is that marijuana use is not going to lead to schizophrenia in the vast majority of people. It could in some individuals, depending on their genes. But I think a more important message here is that The early experimentation, say before the age of 15, with recreational drugs, not just marijuana, but with alcohol and tobacco as well, is much worse for your brain than experimenting with those substances after you're 21. So it is important to get that message out to kids.
Talking with Dr. Lawrence Steinberg, he's the author of Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. If kids are going to do risky behavior, so what are parents supposed to do to let them have that risk but control it so they don't get hurt or put themselves in danger?
You know, I think that what we need to do is to provide structured and supervised settings for kids where they can engage in positive risk-taking, but where they're protected against the kind of risk-taking that can be harmful. So, you know, one example is to encourage our communities and schools to provide good after-school activities for people this age, which they often don't have. We know that the prime time for experimenting with sex and drugs and delinquency is now between 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the afternoon. It's no longer Saturday night, and it's no longer in the back of your car. It's in your own home or in the home of your friends whose parents aren't around. And so I think if we provided opportunities for kids to do stimulating and fun and interesting but supervised activities during the afternoon hours, we could diminish a lot of that negative risk-taking that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Peer pressure. Again, you write about peer pressure and say it's not quite what we think it is.
No, it's not. You know, there clearly is the kind of peer pressure that we do associate with adolescents, where kids are actively encouraging each other to do risky things. But what we've shown in a series of studies that we've done at Temple University is that when kids are in the presence of their friends, even if their friends are not talking to them, just having them around, it seems to affect their brains in ways that make them take more risk. It lights up the brain's reward centers, and what that does is it makes kids much more attentive to the prospects of a reward from a risky choice and less attentive to the downside. And we've actually even shown this in studies with using mice, where we've compared the impact of being around mice the same age on adolescent mice versus adult mice. And in a very interesting study, we showed that when adolescent mice are with their peers, they drink more alcohol than if they're alone, but adult mice drink the same amount whether they're alone or with other mice.
Huh, wow. What's the theory on that?
The theory on that is that during adolescence, we're hardwired to be very social. The system of the brain that we call the social brain is undergoing dramatic and rapid change during adolescence. It's what makes kids so concerned about what other people think of them, and it makes kids very attuned to social cues like the emotional expressions on people's faces, and so we think that peers are so important to adolescents that they actually light up the parts of the brain that are lit up by other kinds of rewards like sex or food. That's how rewarding it is for teenagers to be around other teenagers. And I think that, again, this is something that is hardwired. We see it in other species when they go through puberty, too. And it probably has something to do with making us want to be with people our age at a time when we're ready to mate, so that we don't mate with people who are a lot older or a lot younger.
Mm. But there can be positive peer pressure, too.
Absolutely. I mean, so the impact of peers on adolescents is to make them pay attention to what's rewarding in their environment. And if, you know, we have kids in groups and they're doing something that we want them to do, being around other adolescents is going to make them enjoy that activity more. So one of the things I point out in the book is that we're so hung up in our schools about assessing individuals as individuals that we tend to shy away from collaborative group activities, but actually, given what we know about the impact of peers on the brain, adolescents may enjoy learning more when they're in groups than when they're working on projects by themselves.
Hmm. I mean, that was freaky, though, that you found that people were influenced by people that weren't even physically in the same room as them.
Yeah, I mean, we did a study where we had the people in the brain scanner, and their friends were in another room. They could only see their their performance. They were playing these computer games inside the brain scan there, and their friends could only see their performance on a monitor and, you know, from a distant room. And even still, it affected the way that adolescents played the games. They took a lot more chances. And when we do the same experiments and have an adult in the scanner and the adult's friends are in the room watching, it doesn't affect the way the person plays the game or the person's brain activity at all.
What are schools doing right? What are schools doing wrong?
Well, high schools are not doing a lot that's right these days. Our high schools are probably among the easiest and the most boring in the world. We know this from surveys of kids in the United States and abroad. We don't demand very much from kids in high school. They've become places where the main activity is socializing. You know, that's that's what kids tell us. That's what goes on in school. You know, it's a place to meet up with and hang out with your friends, and, you know, classes just kind of get in the way of that. But mm-hmm. kids tell us that they're bored.
Yeah.
So we're not challenging kids in high school, and as a consequence, we have so many kids entering college who are unprepared, either academically or in terms of psychological characteristics like determination and perseverance and grit. We have the highest, one of the highest college enrollment rates in the world, but we have the lowest college completion rate in the world. In other words, we have the highest percentage of people that start college and don't finish it in the whole developed world. One third of all American kids who start college never get a college degree. In the labor market today, having a couple of years of college doesn't help. You actually have to have a college degree to make the investment pay off. So we need to push kids more in high school and demand more from them so that they're better prepared when they start college so that they can actually graduate.
Mm-hmm. Last question. As somebody who obviously cares about adolescents, what worries you most about kids during their adolescent years?
Well, what worries me most really is the, I think, the inequality gap that is that's affecting adolescents dramatically. So I really think that in the United States there are two adolescences. You know, there's the one that the haves get to have, and there's the one that the have-nots have. And I think that the fact that adolescence is so much longer and that success as an adult requires so many years of school now is really widening the gap, and I think we need to figure out ways of closing it.
Like what? I mean, give me, like what?
Well, I think that we need interventions early in life to help the development of kids who are born into disadvantaged households, and that involves improving, you know, prenatal nutrition and early childhood education and teaching better parenting skills to parents in low-income communities and having better schools for kids in disadvantaged neighborhoods so that they're challenged and pushed their more fortunate, affluent peers are.
Mm-hmm. One other question. When people say it's harder to be a kid today than it ever has been, do you think that's a fair statement or not?
I don't think so. I think adolescence is always challenging. It's different to be a kid today than it has been in the past. I'm not so sure that it's harder, although clearly rates of mental health problems among teenagers are higher today than they have been in previous generations. So, I mean, maybe it is harder in ways that I'm not seeing. But, I think that it's always been a challenging period and one where kids need a lot of help and support from the adults in their lives.
What's the oldest adolescent you've ever heard of?
Well, sometimes when I look in the mirror, I think I'm seeing one, and I'm 62.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you can kiss up to your 60s there, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
So in other words, the book's for everyone, right?
The book is for everyone. I think parents will get a lot out of it. I think teachers will get a lot out of it. Obviously, you know, practitioners, counselors, you know, healthcare professionals who work with kids, but I think it's an interesting read for everybody. I mean, we all have a stake in making sure the next generation is healthy and happy and competent. So I it's a call to action for all of us. And I hope that people read it and think seriously about some of the suggestions I make.
Thanks for all the research you've done. You've done a lot of work to help us.
You're welcome. Thanks. I've enjoyed doing it, and I'm glad that it's making a difference in its own small way.
Dr. Lawrence Steinberg, the author of The Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Whew. All right. 2447, we survived adolescence. We just survived it all over again. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free, 877-291-8255. All right, we'll take a quick commercial break. Coming up shortly here, we're going to talk about a conference that's coming up tomorrow about manufacturing in Vermont. We'll be back right after this.
It's going to be a September to remember.